Welcome to the program. Historians have often said that we always fight new wars with lessons learned from the last one. 10 years ago, after the tragic events of 9/11, we were woefully unprepared for a battle against Al-Qaeda, an organization that existed not in a physical space of a nation-state that might be dealt with by brute force, but rather a 21st century decentralized network that would require not only new methods, but a new geopolitical mindset. We would engage in this war as if we were shadow boxing. This would be a war requiring intelligence, patience, technology, and whole new ways of looking at the world. Long before the death of bin Laden, U.S. efforts had been effectively shrinking and neutralizing Al-Qaeda. How we did this has been a little-known story that is now told by Eric Schmidt and Tom Shanker in their new book, Counterstrike, The Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda. It is my pleasure to welcome Eric Schmidt back to this program this morning. He's the terrorism correspondent for the New York Times. He's been embedded with troops in Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, and Pakistan. He's twice been a member of Times reporting teams that were awarded the Pulitzer Prize. It is my pleasure to welcome Eric Schmidt here to talk about Counterstrike, The Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda. Eric Schmidt, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you very much, Jeff, for having me on.
Good to have you here. One of the things that becomes clear in looking at the overarching story of Al-Qaeda and our battle against it is that they really lived by that kind of old motto of think globally and act locally, and it took us a while to really understand that.
That's right. The initial instinct, perhaps understandably after the 9/11 attacks by the U.S. military and the government at large, was to try and kill and capture its way out of the problem by identifying Al-Qaeda as an organization. They thought by essentially killed enough of the fighters and killed enough of the senior leaders, the organization would wither away. It took about 2 years, really, before the notion to sink in that wasn't working. In fact, in a now kind of memo we talk about in our book, December of 2003, then Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, to a memo to his top aides, asks the essential question: Are we basically killing more terrorists now? Are we generating more terrorists now than we're killing? And he started looking around for different ways of combating terrorism. So that led to a new thinking in the Pentagon and parts of the government, looking at the threat in a more holistic way. So it wasn't just the government, the military, and the intelligence agencies, which are obviously still very important, but other parts of the government as well. Certainly the State Department and diplomats, but other organizations like the Treasury Department, which became instrumental in dealing with trying to cut down on the financial networks that terrorists have. Organizations like the Agriculture Department that help indigenous peoples with their agriculture issues. And also just a much better understanding of what Al-Qaeda was and its organization is, and how terrorists operate as networks, not just vertical organizations, but real networks. And that if you target pieces of that network, you can delay or even thwart some types of attack.
It is interesting that Rumsfeld, for all of the negative reputation that he has in so many different respects, really was at kind of the forefront of coming up with some new ideas to solve this problem when it was clear that the old ideas weren't working.
It is, and I kind of got the old adage that just because Donald Rumsfeld said it doesn't mean it's wrong. kind of proves true here. And he was. He was very frustrated with kind of old think, as he called it then. And what he tapped into was a new way of thinking. I've just described it by a group of interesting individuals in the Pentagon. And what they were trying to do was look at the idea of, can you apply certain elements of traditional Cold War deterrence, that is the theory that kept the peace between the United States and the Soviet Union for all those decades, can you apply some of that to combating terrorism today? Now, the initial reaction by many in the government, including the Pentagon, was, well, of course not. You know, Osama bin Laden is not deterrable, and suicide bombers aren't deterrable. But the more you look at it, you have to think of terrorists operating as a network, that you may have those individuals who are completely committed to the cause, but you also have members of that team that are the logisticians, the gun runners, the financiers. And these are people who aren't nearly as fervent in their beliefs and certainly aren't necessarily going to be ready to die for the cause. And so if you can target those individuals and make it much more difficult to help carry out attacks, it at least pushes these attacks down the road, delays them, and may even reduce some of the ferocity of these attacks. This was a new way of thinking about it, and it's still evolving today.
What were we able to learn by looking at the way Britain and Israel have traditionally dealt with terrorism, almost more as a broad law enforcement issue than as a military issue?
That's right, and it's one of the criticisms that the British and the Israelis have had of the American approach, certainly immediately after 9/11, was their approach was you treat terrorists like you treat common criminals and thugs. Don't elevate them in status. Don't buy into all their religious rhetoric that the whole jihadi language takes on. This idea of a religious war, all that does is increase their status with their people. Treat them as street thugs, and that's the way to deal with that. The other thing that's very important that Britain and Israel and other many countries in Europe, elsewhere in the Middle East, unfortunately had to deal with their own terrorist issues, is the idea of resilience. That is, you're not going to let the terrorists get you down. You're not going to overreact to their attacks. In fact, when the London subway was bombed several years ago, the British famously were cleaning up the debris and obviously pursuing the criminal, the terrorists who conducted the attack, but the Londoners were back on the tube, the London subway, within a matter of several hours. There's this sense of resilience, not just resilience in the infrastructure that's been a focus of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and how, you know, physical buildings and structures can be protected against terrorist attack, but the psychological resilience that the American public needs to withstand another attack. And as we say in our book, we believe the next attack is a matter of time before it comes. And that's something the American public really needs to work on with much help from its political leadership.
There's also a sense, and this comes out in many of the captured documents from Al-Qaeda, that bin Laden, at least, and others in the leadership of Al-Qaeda understood or at least believed that we weren't going to have that resilience, that one, we would be a kind of paper tiger, and two, that we wouldn't be able to have the resilience to withstand a protracted campaign.
Right, and there I think that certainly was Osama bin Laden's thinking in launching the 9/11 attacks. His idea was that if you can hit the Americans hard in the United States, and particularly at their economic base, that is in New York City, and the government base in Washington, D.C., that you'll bloody their nose, you'll basically take them out of the fight, which is what his goal was. You eliminate the U.S., force the U.S. to withdraw its troops from places like Saudi Arabia and other places in the Middle East, and then Al-Qaeda says, then it would go after the local governments that they opposed. He miscalculated, obviously, with the United States sending troops first into Afghanistan and then later into Iraq.
It's interesting that there was this attempt that you write about to immediately after 9/11 even open up lines of communication to bin Laden.
Right. Again, this gets to the idea that you can you identify the leader of an organization. If you can tackle them, you can obviously avoid any further conflict. It also kind of still has this Cold War notion to it, that if you negotiate with your enemy, maybe we can find some way of bargaining. This was more of a setting of red lines, basically warning bin Laden through family members and other intermediaries, if he were to cross certain red lines with weapons of mass destruction, for instance, that much that he held dear, at least the U.S. believed he held dear, family members, for instance, could be in serious jeopardy. Of course, these efforts were met with utter silence.
Talk about how this notion of deterrence sort of sprang up literally from the basement of the Pentagon, how it was initially received, and then we'll talk about how it sort of played out in the field.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. In summer of 2005, there was an ongoing policy effort by a guy named Barry Pavel, who was a longtime Pentagon policy analyst. He was working on various elements of deterrence and among some other projects. And there was a young man named Matt Kronick who came in, a kind of a Hollywood handsome summer intern, really, graduate student, coming in. This was his expertise, as a matter of fact, in graduate school. So Pavel gave Kronick this assignment over a matter of weeks, and Kronick ran with it. And he developed this idea that we talked about before of how you might apply certain elements of Cold War deterrence to deterring, how you might deter terrorists. Again, identifying the networks that they operate in, identified nodes in that network that could be vulnerable to pressure or attack by the United States in some form, whether it's from law enforcement, whether it's from financing, whether it's from actual military attack. This caught the attention of other people in the Pentagon within the chain of command, and it came right at a time when Rumsfeld was looking for some different type of approach to combating terrorism. And it just so happened that he famously kind of met with some top aides. He was quite angry. He demanded, why isn't there more new thinking going around? And Doug Feith, who was the top policy official within the Pentagon at the time, said, we got to get Rumsfeld this paper you guys have been working on. So they rushed it up there, made it into kind of talking points. And within a matter of weeks, Rumsfeld was taking it to President Bush at his summer residence in Texas to review with him.
One of the things that this was predicated on was that it wasn't going to work necessarily in terms of deterrence against the suicide bombers themselves, but against all those people that were in the middle, all those functionaries that you talked about before.
That's right. And again, it gets to this idea of it takes a network to fight a network. And it just can't, in the words of some Pentagon officials early on, cut off the head of the snake and then the whole creature will die. That's just not how Al-Qaeda works. So again, it took a better understanding of how terrorist organizations operate with certain individuals who are charged with the finances and raising money from the institution. Certain parts of it are dealing with the communications, logistics. How do you move fighters back and forth, whether it's into Afghanistan or Iraq? Again, if you target nodes at these different parts of these networks that are more vulnerable to being deterred, I mean, they don't want to be killed necessarily, or they don't want their style of life to change, then this may have an effect. It may have the effect of delaying the ultimate terrorist attack, because at some point the suicide bomber they'll find somebody who will do the job, and they'll get him the equipment that he needs. But it may delay that day, and it may also force the terrorist to take a less ferocious route in terms of the type of attack they might carry out.
Talk about the nexus between these ideas and the ongoing operation that was happening in Iraq.
Well, a lot of these, Iraq becomes kind of a laboratory for many of these ideas, particularly up in northern Iraq. There were a number of commanders who were open to the idea of how you might, for instance, target. They were struggling, for instance, we write in the book, struggling with an IED cell that was going on there. And they discovered that each IED, each suicide bomber that went out, had to be blessed by a certain imam, a religious leader. Well, the military said, well, if we take out the religious leader, then that will delay these attacks. And sure enough, when they did, it delayed by a matter of months until the organization went out and found another emir that was going to be that would be able to bless these attacks. So there was an instance again where you identify what were the key nodes in the network, not just trying to kill every suicide bomber, a potential recruit that they might have, because they're basically an infinite supply of those, but looking at the key individual who made those attacks happen, enabled them.
Talk a little bit about the operation in Sinjar, a town near Syria that you talk about in Counter-Strike.
Yeah, this was a little village on the border of Syria and Iraq, and there was a special operations commando raid there that took place, and one of the things they took away was essentially an Al-Qaeda Rolodex. This was basically a detailed accounting and list of names of the foreign fighters that had infiltrated into Iraq from Syria mainly, but from many other countries, and who these individuals were. And what happened here was the information was the commanders made an unusual decision to take all this information that was collected by the Special Operations Forces and declassify it, which is pretty unusual. Usually this kind of stuff stays within very highly classified channels and you pursue individuals. What the commander at the time, Stanley McChrystal, decided, let's declassify it, put this in the hands of one of our most seasoned diplomats, a guy named Del Daley, who just also happened to be a former three-star general in the Special Operations Command. He was now the State Department's top counterterrorism official, and his assignment was to go basically around the Middle East and North Africa and go to the capitals of these countries with lists of the fighters that were from these documents that they scooped up in Sinjar and confront the governments in these countries and say, we have lists of individuals. And these were very detailed lists. One of the things about Al-Qaeda was almost anal in their record-keeping in terms of the names of individuals, how old they were, where they came from, how much they'd been paid, all these kind of things. So you go back to this very detailed list to the Egyptians, to the Tunisians, even to the Libyans, and say, look, here, we've got a very detailed list of these guys coming out of your country, and while you may not care so much if they're fighting in Libya right now, in Iraq right now, many of these guys could well come back and be a real problem for you later on. Well, the lights went on in many capitals, and suddenly there was a great deal more of cooperation by these countries in cracking down on the networks within their own countries that were sending young men to become suicide bombers in Iraq, and the number of suicide bombers was cut dramatically as a result of this effort.
It really was sort of threatening that there could be blowback from this to these various countries in the region.
That's right, and that's one of the reasons that it was attracted to them. It wasn't just altruistic that you helped the Americans in Iraq, which obviously was a very unpopular war at the time in the Middle East, but for General Daley to show the civilian and military leaders and intelligence leaders of these countries that they had, in some cases, dozens, in many cases, scores of individuals, some of who could come back, obviously having learned many lessons on the battlefield in Iraq, they could be much more dangerous when they returned than when they left. And so it was in the self-interest of these various countries to cooperate with the United States in this effort.
One of the things that took us longer, it seems like, to understand was the messaging part of this. One of the things you talk about is that in so many of the captured documents, it shows that Al-Qaeda really understood the Iraqi people far better than we did.
Yeah, and this still is one of the Achilles heels, Jeff, of the ongoing effort to combat terrorism, both overseas and increasingly here in the United States domestically, in that the United States has gotten very good at tactical operations on the ground with the military and the intelligence community working very well together. They still aren't very good, though, in countering the basic message that Al-Qaeda has. It's a very simple but effective one, that the West, the United States, is at war with Islam. Now, how do you deal with that kind of message, particularly when they see the United States continue to carry out airstrikes in places like Afghanistan, drone strikes in Pakistan, the ongoing struggle between the Israelis and the Palestinians? This all feeds into that rhetoric. So what the Americans have tried to do is very quietly enlist help, to some extent from some of the Arab governments and Muslim governments in Muslim countries, but also reach out to credible voices in the religious communities of these countries, imams who are respected, who can go toe-to-toe rhetorically with many of these same Al-Qaeda militants. This is obviously quite dangerous for these individuals in these countries, and of course they can't be associated with the United States in any way, because that would undermine the credibility. But this has been one of the ongoing efforts, is to try and enlist individuals who have credibility on the ground, oftentimes with young people, who can combat this message and really demonstrate, at least the American hope would be, demonstrate kind of how bankrupt the Al-Qaeda ideology really is.
Why have we had such trouble with this whole counter-messaging idea? I mean, there have been noticeable successes. I mean, you talk about some of the things Ray Ordinaro did out in the field in Iraq that sort of reversed the trends a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's really been kind of learning by trial and error in the field where you might be able to do this, where you can develop a message that has some resonance on the ground. And one of the most effective messages they've had is this whole idea that Al-Qaeda is not only bankrupt ideologically, but the vast majority of attacks that Al-Qaeda and its various affiliates and other groups have carried out, the victims of these attacks have been Muslims, oftentimes women and children. So when you can challenge people like, I mean, al-Zawahiri, now the number one official in Al-Qaeda, succeeded Osama bin Laden in his online discourses that he's had. This poses problems for them when they are forced to be on the defensive in trying to respond to some of these allegations that are coming from kind of respected Muslim clerics and intellectuals as well.
One of the other areas where this war is being fought that you spend a lot of time talking about is the whole cyber world, the whole online world, and that we've gotten better in monitoring that and crunching all of the information that we get from that.
That's right, Jeff. I mean, it's so important. As we point out in our book, the cyber world, the Internet, is really the ultimate safe haven for terrorists. It's where they do much of their recruiting, their communications, raising money for financing, and even in the world of virtual gaming right now, many of the games your teenagers may be using online and are now being used as terrorists by terrorists. But what they do is they develop code words that mimic the vernacular of the gaming community, so that you really can't tell if you're an American intelligence analyst monitoring these things, who's playing the real game and who's exchanging information about the next possible attack. One of the things that the American community has done very effectively, we describe, is basically hacking into the cyber networks of some of these terrorists and some of the cell phone networks of these terrorists, infiltrate these networks, and basically pose as militants themselves in order to raise objections, raise questions, and basically the purpose is to sow dissent and confusion in these ranks so the militants who do go online and are listening and watching these kind of things, they don't know who's who and who to believe, and hopefully that'll dissuade them from following these movements in the future.
Has Al-Qaeda made specific changes in response to some of the things that we've been doing, some of the things we've talked about here today?
Well, I think the gaming example I just gave in the cyber world is one area where it just becomes where they know the Americans in the West are getting better at penetrating some of their cyber networks, and so they are now piggybacking on some of the most common computer gaming options that are out there right now, which makes it very difficult for the NSA, the National Security Agency, the country's top code-breaking agency, to distinguish between what's just a young kid playing one of these games and what might be a terrorist in the Middle East somewhere.
One of the things that's particularly interesting about all this as well is the way in which policy pretty much remained the same, with some subtle differences, more of nuance, it seems, than anything else, between the Bush administration, at least the second Bush administration, and the Obama administration.
Right, and you put your finger on it. The big difference really came between the first and second Bush administrations, when you had a real sea change in the thinking of many of the senior officials, in the idea that really did take a more of a holistic approach to government. You needed to work more closely with allies. The U.S. couldn't go it alone, this kind of worldwide global fight. And certainly President Obama carried through on many of these policies. He enhanced others and certainly accelerated and expanded the drone program in Pakistan that President Bush first accelerated in the summer of 2008, to the point where in President Obama's first year in office, 2009, there were more drone strikes in Pakistan than all 8 years combined under the Bush administration. That increased in 2010 as well. President Obama, of course, tried to frame terrorism in a different way than President Bush did. Basically, in the Bush foreign policy was viewed in almost all respects viewed through a counterterrorism lens. The Obama administration tried to put counterterrorism in a prominent place, but not make it the only gauge through which foreign policy is carried out. It's one pillar of a multi-pillared approach toward foreign policy problems. And certainly President Obama himself, as the son of a father born in Kenya, obviously an African-American, brings a whole different approach. And certainly the whole image of an American president looks much different to the rest of the world than the previous president. So he was trying to capitalize on that as well, and certainly tapping into that in his Cairo speech in 2009, and reaching out to communities around the world, not just looking to deal with issues just through the counterterrorism arena, but in various aspects of foreign policy.
Right. And again, coming back to that messaging idea that we talked about before.
Exactly. It was the whole idea of how do you reach out to various communities, Muslim communities, and don't deal with them just on counterterrorism issues, but how can we deal with them on education issues, on agriculture issues, on business issues, on exchange of scientific programs, on a wide range of issues. I think there's been some disappointment both among President Obama's supporters here in the U.S. and abroad that many of the expectations that were raised in the Cairo speech haven't been really fulfilled. There wasn't a dramatic rollout of new programs after that. It was on a smaller scale, often embassy by embassy around the world. And so I think a lot of those promises people are still waiting for them to be delivered.
One of the things that's happened while we've cut off the proverbial head of the snake with the death of bin Laden, there's been the continual evolution that you talk about of these Al-Qaeda affiliates, with Yemen being the one that is arguably the most dangerous.
Right, and this was a plan of bin Laden's all along, as you start with a base in Pakistan, the organization founded there, or or at least based there after they were tossed out of Afghanistan. And the idea was to develop these affiliates that you now have, as you say. You've got one in North Africa, you have one in East Africa, out of Kenya, you have some wannabes, adherents in Somalia, but the most dangerous one right now, as you've identified, is the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Yemen. This is the organization that was responsible for the so-called underwear bomber, the young man who was had explosives sewn in his underwear, tried to blow up an aircraft over Detroit on Christmas in 2009. They were also responsible for the so-called printer cartridge plot, which is about 10 months later, where Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is the formal name of this Yemen affiliate, packed explosives and printer cartridges and put them on air cargo planes, the idea that they'd explode either over the ocean or over Chicago. Both of these plots were thwarted, but American counterterrorism officials say right now that this part of Al-Qaeda, the branch in Yemen, is probably poses the biggest threat to the American homeland of any part of the Al-Qaeda organization.
And one of the ways that Al-Qaeda has adapted to all that we have been talking about is really looking not for the big game changer as 9/11 might have been 10 years ago, but really smaller attacks along the way.
That's right. That kind of goes along with the growth of these affiliates. I mean, they're still, the way I look at it, the way we talk about it in our book, is that there's really a two-track approach now. You still have parts of Al-Qaeda that are trying to obtain weapons of mass destruction and use them for some type of mass casualty attack, a la 9/11. But more and more common, I think, are, as you've mentioned, smaller-scale attacks. And by small, it could mean, you know, going after a single aircraft, but it could also be something like the Fort Hood attack, the Major Hassan. Somebody with an automatic weapon goes into a closed area like he did, or into a supermarket or a shopping center or somewhere, and shoots people up, kind of like the Mumbai attacks in India. And the whole notion that Al-Qaeda is saying is to individuals, do whatever you can to carry out this fight against the Americans, whether it's with a large-scale attack or if it's easier for you, which obviously would be for most, to do it on a much smaller scale. And those, by the way, Jeff, are much harder to detect than a complicated 9/11-style plot that has a lot of moving parts that you can, if you detect one part, it'll tip you off to the rest of the plot.
Eric Schmidt, his book is Counterstrike, The Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda. Eric, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate it.
It.